Welcome to another episode of One Door at a Time, Concentric Educational Solutions podcast, where we look at the intersection between politics, education, and community. We are in the midst, in the home stretch of the political season, and it is my distinct privilege to have Councilwoman Porter representing the 10th District of Baltimore City as a guest today. Really look forward to having this. She's been so gracious in one, communicating. Thank you so much. Two, you are the only council person on time and you were early.
Yes.
That's facts. No shade to my past guest, but she beat you all to it. So let's hop right into it.
Sure.
You're a native Baltimorean. Yeah. Talk about your background. Like, where'd you grow up? And like, what are some of the early things that, you know what I mean, that really shaped who you are?
Yeah, so I grew up in Emerson Village right here in Baltimore City.
EV.
EV. EV all day. You know, it comes out a little bit.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But, you know, my family lived around the Emerson Village area, Mount Holly area. And so I have, you know, generations here. Both mother and father, their families live here and in Baltimore City. And people know my family, you know, in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They know my mom's family, and they know my dad's family. My dad was an avid basketball player. And so my mom, she was very, you know, vocal with her brothers and sisters in the community. So they actually taught me kind of that grit and that Baltimore resilience that, you know, it's just now being coined as Baltimore grit and Baltimore
resilience. Yes,
yes. That was something that I grew up on. And so growing up in Baltimore, I knew that I wanted to be something different. I'm a vocal performance artist by training. So Baltimore School of Performing Arts was kind of like my entrance into public life.
Because did you know that was going to be your destination?
I thought it was going to be my destination. So I thought I was going to be a performer for my life. But I realized very quickly that I wanted to do something else and make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And I transitioned into the sciences. And so from there, kind of went through kind of public health, went through medicine. I wanted to be a physician by training.
Oh, okay.
Just what I had seen in my family, substance abuse, domestic violence, that kind of shaped my background. But then when I got to the Army studying suicidal behavior,
you were in the Army?
No, so I was just a civilian.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I knew that kind of like the shift needed to happen where I wanted to do more population level work. And that's when I transitioned into policy.
So as you go growing up at EV, you know, one of my first experiences in Baltimore City, my first year was at teaching at Forest Park.
Yes.
Then I went to, has its own history in Baltimore, but then I went to Southwestern High School.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the very first time that I saw how entrenched neighborhoods were in Baltimore. It was probably my first or second day of school. I was a new assistant principal and we let out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're familiar with Southwestern.
Yes.
And it was the largest student fight between Baltimore Hilton and Emerson Village.
Yes.
Right?
It's still like that.
It's entrenched.
It's entrenched.
Right? So
it's entrenched.
Me being new, I brought the parents in and realized that the parents had fought.
Yeah.
Like it was really generational between Baltimore Hilton and Emerson and V.
Yes.
Like it was crazy.
Yeah.
Right? Like so now you go to Baltimore School of the Arts, right?
For the TWIGS program, yep.
Yes.
I went there for the TWIGS program.
So as you go through it, like and you start shaping who you want to become.
Yeah.
How'd you decide on, because you went undergrad at Towson, right?
I did, yeah.
How'd you decide on Towson?
Towson was actually my safety school, so I was supposed to go to Howard.
The Mecca. Okay.
I was supposed to go there. I was so excited. But unfortunately, they had lost my entire application.
Wow.
And I was, you know, I was like, you know, I needed to get into a school pretty quickly. And Towson was one of my safety schools. And I applied and I got in, got some scholarship money, and kind of went there for molecular biology and biochemistry. I auditioned for the vocal performance program, but, you know, I knew that I wanted to do something in the sciences.
That's those tough majors.
Yeah,
That's a very tough major.
Yeah. I can read well.
Yeah. When you're coming through, what was Baltimore like in your formative years in like high school?
So Baltimore, in my formative years, I would have to say it was culturally relevant. And I say that because that was during the time where K-Swift was out. And
okay,
everybody,
yeah, yeah.
K-Swift,
yeah, okay,
forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so everybody was, you know, really into club music. Everybody was, you know, really into Baltimore.
Yeah.
That is where I feel Baltimore kind of got its start. When we talk about Miss Tony, when we talk about Kay Swift, when we talk about all of the radio personalities that really shaped where Baltimore was going and how Baltimore is kind of perceived now, that's where, you know, I grew up in that era. So I grew up with Horns 2003. I grew up with, you know, Kay Swift. I grew up with Quicksilver. You know, listen to him on the radio. So I grew up hearing that, going to a private high school in East Baltimore. So, you know, my mom would take me early in the morning to East Baltimore Institute of Notre Dame. So I grew up listening to all of them. I grew up really understanding that Baltimore is unique. Baltimore is very unique. I've traveled many places across the world and I have never known, felt, or seen a place like Baltimore.
Talk more about, like, what do you think gives it that distinction?
Oh my gosh, it's the neighborhoods and the people. You know, you can go to anywhere in the nation and start talking to's, do's, and news, and they know exactly where you're from. You can start talking about egg custard with the marshmallow, which is like a Baltimore staple. You can talk about Mr. G's.
Yes, yes.
You know, these are things that people know about Baltimore. And I actually take a different approach as an elected official. So I lean into that.
Facts.
You know,
facts,
there are so many people that talk so negatively about Baltimore, but I lean into, you know, having the old grandmas watch out for me when I'm walking home from their windows. I talk about the young men on the corner that knew that I was trying to get a good education, and they would make sure that I would stay,
absolutely,
you know, stay on the straight and narrow. They talk about the musicians and the art scene here in Baltimore. Yeah. You know, that's what I choose to dive into.
So I remember in undergrad, '96 to 2000 at Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And like that is, you know, Drew Hill coming through.
Yep.
And I'm just, it's amazing that, you know, I get to Baltimore.
Yes.
And it's, there is that grit that you said that's been termed now. It's tangible. You can feel it. And that no matter where you go, like there's a pull for me wherever I travel, like to get back to Baltimore. It's a renewal sometimes,
right?
And just feeling it. And then, you know, you see all the development that has happened, that's happening in Baltimore. And it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword sometimes, but it's powerful. So now you're an undergrad. Mm-hmm. Like, tell me what are some of the experiences in undergrad that kind of impacted you?
Working four jobs. So I was actually a really hard worker because I was on scholarship. So I knew that I had to make the grades, but I knew I also needed to pay my cell phone bill.
Yes.
So I knew that I had to work very hard in order to get there. I was the first person in my family to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that on my back and having that in my brain constantly, you know, made sure that I showed up 8 o'clock in the morning for labs, made sure I stayed late to take advantage of all that Towson had to offer me. And now I'm on the board of Towson University. So pushing for other first generation African Americans or persons of color to actually get to that realm and get to that table and be comfortable and be supported in a way that will make them flourish. We have about a large majority of people their first year, they leave because it's financial reasons or they just can't keep up with the culture of being in college.
And even that, you know, I mean, you're unique in that you actually graduated in the sciences, right? Like that doesn't happen. It's like a huge drop off.
Huge drop,
right?
With eight girls.
Yeah,
only one.
It's a huge drop off. Like across the board, it's disproportionate with people of color dropping up from the science or switching majors if they don't drop enough.
Yep.
Like, what made you want to stick through it?
Yeah.
As hard as it may have gotten.
Yeah. So I'm not even going to hold you. It was really the money that I would make when I came out of undergrad. So, you know, I knew that I had to have a job when I got out of college. I knew that in order to sustain myself, I had to do that. My parents were working class parents. And so you know, having that opportunity where they would, you know, pay for everything was just not an option. And they literally did the best that they could to get me to where I needed to go. But mm-hmm. I knew in order for me to take it to the next level, I had to show up in a way that was more adult at 18 than many people deal with when they're 28 and 30.
Because we all have our unique stories that, mm-hmm. that ground us, that guide us, that form us. So now you're going through undergrad, you're getting ready to graduate. Yeah. Like what are you thinking about what to do?
Yeah. So my next steps was to get a job. That was like, you know, my mother, you know, bless her heart, she wanted me to work for the judiciary, work for, you know, get a good government job.
Good government job, yeah.
But I knew that I wanted to continue school. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wanted to work in the sciences, possibly in D.C., and that's where I headed. So I went to the NIH.
Okay.
I was there for about 5 years, developed a program there, worked on Capitol Hill at HHS, so I was able to expand my opportunities with the help of mentors at Towson.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then you go to grad school.
I did, yeah.
Okay. Where'd you end up going?
Morgan State University. Morgan State.
Shout out to the Bears.
Yes.
They stole my blue and orange. I went to Lincoln. But what made you go to Morgan?
Yeah.
Continue at Morgan.
So I was actually working at the Army at the time, and a young lady there was getting her doctorate program, and I was looking at, you know, I was looking at Hopkins, I was looking at University of Maryland, and she said, "Why don't you consider Morgan?" Mm-hmm. And I said, I never really considered Morgan. The dean, Dr. Kim Sidnor, mm-hmm. She met with me and kind of explained to me the magic of Morgan and being amongst your people at a historically Black institution in college, what that is like for your lens of your professional career. Mm-hmm. Because I often remind people, Morgan has an exceptional public health program where I was able to get training that, mm-hmm. you know, people in their entire professional career did not get this type of professional training mm-hmm. that is culturally competent, that is systemic, and that is also like for persons of color.
Morgan, so I went to grad school at Temple.
Yes.
Which I consider HBCU just mm-hmm. without the designation
yes.
or Philly. Then I went into Morgan for my doctorate.
Yep.
And it was the people that were the professors
yes.
that were pouring in at Morgan.
Yes.
Reminded me of Lincoln, mm-hmm. But they were producing beasts,
yes.
like really high in so many of the disciplines,
mm-hmm.
and really prepping us mm-hmm. With the tangible and intangible skills that we're going to need.
Yes.
So now you finish Morgan.
Yep.
Then you go on to another one.
I went to University of Maryland.
Okay.
So I did a master in science and law. So I was really looking to kind of offset that public health degree with regulatory science. And so with that degree, I'm able to kind of work on Capitol Hill, work mm-hmm. as a legislative director, write laws, work on laws and policies at the federal, state, or local level.
What's shaping you as you go to each of these steps? Like mm-hmm. what is your North Star of where you want to go?
Financial incentive and the diversity of the jobs that I would get.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say being an elected official here on the city council is probably my first job where I have placed people and purpose ahead of the actual salary of a council person.
So first of all, thank you for the vulnerability mm-hmm. and transparency. Mm-hmm. Most people wouldn't say that. And it's facts, right? So yeah. like people
you gotta survive.
You know, people ask me now, it's like, well, you're a businessman, right? Mm-hmm. Like, do you? Yes, I do. But to do a lot of the work, I have to make money. There has to be the number one job of a business is to stay in business
yes.
and then give back.
Yes.
So what was your trajectory or what were you thinking about? Because you were talking before we went on air about your unique circumstance at that time of
yes.
going into a public service. Like
yeah.
what started making you think about it?
Yeah. So I will tell you, one of my mentors, Senator Antonio Hayes.
Shout out to the Noops. Fraternity Incorporated.
Yes. I remember meeting him and Quentin Lathan, which is one of his, you know, greatest friends,
mm-hmm.
At ARCO over in Poplar Grove. So, you know, with a 15
yeah.
and a 23, so where they ended
up, uh-huh.
ARCO used to meet there. And I met with him and I was just, you know, kind of lamenting what was happening in my community.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what are you going to do about it? And
where were you living at?
I was actually living in Mount Vernon at the time.
You were in Mount Vernon? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he said, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And folks that know me know that you can't challenge me and not, you know, I'm a show up every time. So I think he knew that. And that kind of started my entrance into public service. And I used to be known as the girl that used to follow Antonio around at all the community meetings. So I shadowed him.
And he's an OG.
He's an OG in the game. And I definitely respect his opinion. And, you know, his policy issues on a lot of things. Now we're at a point where he comes to me as like, Pete Porter, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
So he comes to me as a peer now, but I definitely still hold him and Quentin and Anthony Jones in very high regard with regard to like how I shape my policy and how I execute and just kind of show up as an elected official. But he said, what are you going to do about it? I started researching what I could do about it. And so I ran the first time for Democratic State Central Committee.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, you know, I really, at the time, I really did not understand what that position and how important that position is. And I lost. And I remember, you know, Hayes came and got me and said, you know, take it on the chin, do better next time. The next time I did it, it was 14 people. And usually with Central Committee, they kind of just go down by seven.
Yeah.
I was number 14 and I made it up to number four. So that means that people had to search for me. And so I kind of just delve right into community engagement and community service and what public service really needs.
So then you run in 2020. You win.
Yes. Crowded race.
Crowded race in the midst of the pandemic.
Yes.
What are some of the early lessons that you learned when you became elected that you didn't expect?
Once I became elected?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. You don't know everything. You know, one of the things that I often remind candidates is that people that have ran for these offices, secured these offices, they got there by an approach, whether it's a good approach or whether it's a bad approach. They got there by an approach and they were successful. Learn from them. Take an opportunity to talk to people that agree with you and take an opportunity to talk with people that don't agree with you. And that's exactly when I got in. I ran in a crowded race of nine, very competent community people in South Baltimore. And I took it as an opportunity to meet with each of them or, you know, extend the opportunity to meet with each of them to figure out how we can work together. And I will tell you, now that I'm running for reelection, a majority of competitors back in 2020, they are now endorsing my campaign, my reelection campaign, because I took an opportunity to not, you know, just discard them and not keep them into the fold of District 10, because obviously they had something to say.
Absolutely.
And being a humble leader enough to know and to work with people that you may or may not necessarily agree with. So that was the first thing I learned when I got in. You don't know everything. Number two, be kind to people.
Thank you. You know? Thank you. Thank you.
I often remind people as a former staffer, I often remind people, power is not displayed by what you say. Power is displayed by what you do.
Okay.
And so you don't need to, you know, bulldoze your way through, you know, and, you know, you don't need to bulldoze your way through. Take a step back and figure out, one, who really holds the power, because I will often remind people it's those executive assistants. They're the one, they're the gatekeepers. And be nice. And you never know who is there going to help you to the next level. And I will tell you, over my 4 years, it has been those people, those hardworking people in city agencies that have made District 10 the success that it is today.
And it's shown immense growth in the stuff that you have done and continue to do.
Thank you.
What are some of the challenges that you ran into that you didn't expect as an elected official?
Being one of the youngest Black women on the council, we're served by four women on the council right now. We
yes.
have Vice Chair Sharon Green Middleton, an amazing, amazing mentor.
Okay.
We have Chairwoman Danny McCray, another amazing mentor that has helped navigate me. We have Councilwoman Odette Ramos, who in her own right has been kind of an OG in the housing game. She has helped me as well. Being able to kind of just sit and learn and hear from them, that was probably like the biggest kind of like lessons learned as an African-American woman. Because most people think, and, you know, the former councilman, Ed Reisinger, we were actually at a site visit. Most people think I was the admin assistant.
Mm.
And he actually got me into a posture of leading people.
Mm.
And so that was probably the biggest challenge, like leaning into that posture as a young African-American woman.
Wow. Going into the home stretch of the election, at least with the primary, but what do you see being a native Baltimorean for your life, entire life?
Yeah.
What do you see as the biggest opportunities and the biggest challenges facing us, you know, in the near future?
In the near future, I would have to say apathy and empowerment. Mm. When I talk to voters, they have such apathy for city officials and Baltimore city government in general.
Mm.
And so changing that narrative to get them to believe in Baltimore city again, that's probably the most recent challenge that I believe as a people we're going to have to overcome. Secondarily, when we're talking about Baltimore keeping its grit and its resilience and its culture, that's probably going to be the secondary challenge that I see for us moving forward. And it's an opportunity for growth. It's an opportunity for us to lean into what so many people for decades have been saying about Baltimore across the nation, but we don't see here in Baltimore. I I've traveled across the nation in other cities, and they look to Baltimore as a leader. They believe that Baltimore is doing cutting edge work, but we have to make sure that our people here are feeling it and they see the cutting edge work that we are doing across the nation.
And Baltimore is so unique because we are urban, we're city. We're small enough that you know so many people, you know, small and more, right? And there's just, I mean, it's just tremendous growth opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the things that we're seeing now, like the intersection, like with education.
Yes.
It's always, whether it be, you know, education as a hot topic, economic development or opportunity, healthcare. You know, do you see that, do you see any correlation between education and public health?
Oh, most definitely. There's an incredible correlation when we're talking about, and I mean, COVID was the prime example.
Yes.
When you had people really having conversations at their dinner table about who their primary care provider is.
Yeah.
Public health has been saying that for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Having an opportunity to make a plan to access, you know, hospital institutions, access different items related to your healthcare. So transportation, education, having the literacy to understand.
Yes.
That has been talked about for decades, but it kind of, you know, intersected during COVID and people really began to take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, we've been having conversations around, you know, there's in education sphere, there's this big, you know, the buzzwords about chronic absenteeism. People, students aren't just coming. It's always been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an opportunity to have Councilman Stokes on here and we talked about it. And it's not chronic absenteeism, students not coming to school is not just a education issue. It's a public health issue.
Yes,
if they're not, like, there's so many intersections there, and not trying to combat these things in isolation, right? And how can we bring the education sector and the government sector and the private sector into one and really talk about what we're doing to support young people, right? Like, and being very intentional and very open and very collaborative in that space. What are the, say three things that you're focusing on for your next term that you want to
do? So for my next term,
because you're gonna get reelected.
Thank you. My next term, I'm gonna be focusing on economic development. This groundwork for my first term was really about resetting city services and really how people view District 10, South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
When people think of South Baltimore, they think of Districts 1 and 11.
This was an
opportunity for the 13 communities surrounding, you know, in District 10, surrounding kind of like that area in South Baltimore to get some love too. So resetting that whole narrative, resetting city services, how people see District 10 in South Baltimore, having that economic footprint. So that was a huge, huge issue that in the latter half of the 4 years, we really, really focused on. The next one is going to be environmental sustainability. So, and during my first term, we really leaned into taking advantage of environmental sustainability within our communities and that advocacy. So we're talking about going up against coal. You know, communities down in Curtis Bay have coal literally on their homes, which are from a number of industrial.
Yeah,
from a number of industrial methods, and really is by city ordinance. In the next term, we're really going to be focusing on how we can advocate at our state and federal level in order to make those environmental changes happen.
Wow. I want to thank you for stopping by. You've been more than gracious. Thank you for taking my texts, working with our assistant. I mean, through your assistant, like just getting it on the books and just being kind, right? It was interesting. Like this 2023-24 has kind of been a whirlwind with the investment that we got and all that stuff. And it's like these issues were always persistent, always had an opportunity to connect. But people being very kind. You know, when I asked Councilman Stokes, I said, who on the council can I get? You were the very first person he named. I mean, yeah, that's OG. But, you know, I just want to thank you. Continued success. You have Concentric support. Continue to do the great work. And thank you for your service and dedication to Baltimore.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of One Door at a Time. Concentric Educational Solutions podcast with intersection of community education and politics. Shout out as always to Atlas Restaurant Group. You can catch them in, I think they have 34, 35. Every week it changes. Shout out to Alex and his brother for supporting us. You can always, as always, you can go to concentric.world and get all of our social media. Until next time, I'm David Heber, your host. Be blessed.
Thank you.
Be blessed.